like it.
You want a podcast like it? Podcast like it. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it. You want a podcast like it? 1999.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 99 from inside a bubbling shit-filled toilet bowl here in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Felisco.
And today we have with us our Catholic correspondent, John O'Connor. He only does movies about the Catholic Church in one form or another.
I mean, no, I also did 200 Cigarettes, which you I believe is the ultimate atheist film of all time.
It is.
But I'm glad to be here because not only was I raised Catholic, I was also raised 2 minutes from where Kevin Smith was raised.
And really?
I am so immersed in the VSQ universe. This is an honor to be here.
This is, you're the perfect guest then because... Anyway, yes, please, Kenny.
Where were you raised?
I was raised in Monmouth County, Middletown, New Jersey, directly next to Leonardo. I have rented movies from RST Video. This is the only thing that I could honestly say I'm an expert on is the early VSQ things. I used to post on the message board. I used to be in the chat room. The chat room moderator was Andy Milonakis, and he banned me when I was 12.
Do you have any current relationship with Andy Milonakis?
None.
I don't say this often. I'm a little embarrassed, though I shouldn't be. I think his show is one of the most brilliant shows that has ever been on TV. I know every word to that theme song, and it's not like I saw it when I was like 12, but that was on in my 20s. I fucking love the Andy Milonakis show, and I don't feel like anybody else holds it up as a high point in alt comedy, which it is.
The weird thing about the Andy Milonakis show is, one, I do have a complicated relationship with Andy Milonakis, as he did ban me from the VSQ chat room when I was 12. But then on top of that, it was the very first show where I had friends who worked on the show. And that made me not watch it because if I ever had like a bad opinion of it, it taught me a great lesson because like a lot of my friends wrote on it and I just pretended that I never saw an episode, even though I think I saw probably like 2 episodes, but I didn't want to talk shit.
They're all geniuses, obviously. All right. Well, we don't need to talk about Andy Milonakis. We need to talk about Kevin Smith and the VSQ universe.
I would say Andy Milonakis is kind of a shorter Kevin Smith. That's it. They're the same. They're the same person.
They're so far from the same person. Cards on the table. Don't like Kevin Smith's movies. I'm fine with Chasing Amy. My guess is if I watched it now, I would not like it. Did not like Clerks when I saw it. Think Mallrats is one of the worst movies ever made. I thought Dogma when I saw it was a masterpiece. And then I grew up. And I think like Cop Out's one of the worst movies ever made. I think really he's a very bad writer and maybe a bad director. So I know that's going to put me in conflict with a lot of people, maybe on this podcast and maybe in the world. And I know it's not a nice thing to say, but I got to tell you, I got to be me. And that's how I feel upon rewatch. There is something about this movie I don't hate. I think it ends really well. And I wish the whole movie had the spirit of the final 10 to 15 minutes of this movie. That's my feeling.
So, I don't have drastically dissimilar feelings about Kevin Smith as a filmmaker with you, Kenny. Like I have issues with the fact that, he loves his own words more than anybody loves. I mean, not anybody. Sorkin probably loves his words more than Kevin Smith, but Kevin Smith really loves his own words.
But Sorkin's words are lovable.
I'll say this. I understand why Clerks was what it was, and I understand why Kevin Smith might not be capable necessarily of growing outside of a very kind of specific lane. That's where he lives, and I don't necessarily hold it against him, even if I'm not necessarily a fan. That being said, I went into this movie with very low expectations. I saw this film in 99. I thought it was fine. It didn't really leave much of an impression. The shit monster was, or the shit demon was the thing that stayed with me for what that's
Never
worth.
Never forget the shit demon.
And I kind of went into this with very low expectations and was pleasantly surprised that this movie actually has some stuff to say. I am not a religious person by any means, but I'm generally speaking a fan of magic realism, of the supernatural. And if you take the religious component out of this film, which I understand is nearly impossible to do, but if you're capable of doing that, there is a fun supernatural magic realism comedy to be had here that I was kind of on board with. And a lot of the problems that I generally have with a Kevin Smith film, for whatever reason, didn't bother me as much in this film. Not really. We'll find out why, but that's where I stand on it.
Here's where I stand on Kevin Smith. As a young boy from New Jersey, there was nobody more important to me than Kevin Smith. From the first time I saw Clerks as an 11-year-old and seeing that it was like places that I knew, it was incredible to see that in like a film. Like,
sure.
The quick stop. It was so important to me. And then when I was 14 when this movie came out, I remember I was walking in Red Bank, New Jersey, past Jay and Silent Bob's Secret Stash. Kevin Smith was in there and my stomach dropped. And I went in with my mom and I bought the screenplay book of Dogma. And Kevin Smith signed it for me and said, like, the message read, don't show this to any clergyman. And it like truly was probably the most important moment of my childhood. Like, do I like Clerks now? Probably not. I think it's like, I do think Kevin Smith is a decent writer who's writing things that he shouldn't be writing. I feel like if Kevin Smith was a television writer in like a sitcom room, which I have a comment about Dogma with this, he has a sitcom rhythm to his writing that I you don't really see in movies, and it kind of stands out that I appreciate a little bit. But he's a terrible director. He's an awful director. He's probably, I would say, the worst person, the worst director in history to make 8 movies.
Like, I think he's the worst director in history to make movies over a $5 million budget. More than one, I would say.
100%. Like, the fact that Deb Kaplan and Harry Elfont are in movie jail after Josie and the Pussycats, and Kevin Smith wasn't there after Mallrats is fucking insane. And like, I've seen Mallrats close to 30 times, and I'm saying this.
So that's so funny you should say that, because I literally was watching Can't Hardly Wait before this went on. 10 minutes ago. It might even be, you know, still here, because I only watch Pluto TV, so whatever's on is what I watch. Pluto is the go-to of all true television fans. So,
are they sponsoring this episode?
I wish. I'm a big Pluto fan. Maybe they would give me free-er TV. I agree. I agree with you on Josie the Pussycats. I agree with you on those two. I think they're tremendous, and it's crazy. I do want to say, like, about Kevin Smith, his story is interesting. I'm a big fan of people like putting everything on the line for what they want to do and having it succeed. I think he has been a force for good in a lot of ways. He kind of waded into the Hollywood pool before it was cool to be someone like him, before it was cool to basically be a stoner comic book guy. And that's a good thing. I think we've gotten a lot of really, really, really good media and content because of people who felt comfortable entering this fray because of him. He seems like a good guy. He seems like he really cares about younger talent. he seems like he really cares about the IP and about the work and all that. In a lot of ways, he is. I mean this in a lot of ways. He is the best of us. He just probably shouldn't be directing movies, in my opinion, and he shouldn't be directing movies like this. This feels to me, and just to set the stage a little more, when I was 17 in 1999, I distinctly remember making a top 10 movie list of all time, and Dogma being number 9. So yeah, I thought this was revelatory when I saw it. And the reason I thought it was revelatory was I was a little, you know, I was a little budding atheist who little budding atheist and a little budding, like, you know, wannabe socialist, who despised organized religion, like deep in my bones, right? And to have someone put a movie out that basically said, I also despise organized religion. This is an enlightened point of view. You can feel comfortable having this point of view was actually really helpful for me. Now, looking at it as like an older person who still has no real love for organized religion, but has a lot more empathy and compassion for people who do practice religion and practice religion and, you know, the organized religions of this country and others, I think it's so fucking petty and so lame and so inch deep and so smug. And so preachy. It's like one of the preachiest movies you will ever see. I really, truly despise everything it aims for right now. So that's really where I come down.
Oh, wow. I mean,
go ahead, John.
I just want to say, I'm the exact opposite, where I feel like this is the greatest movie ever made to feature the line "snooch to the motherfucking mooch." Nooch.
It's probably true.
100. It's easily his best movie, and it's actually a good movie, because the thing that I never noticed until last night, he actually says what he's doing. The movie's fucking Star Wars, like, completely. It's like a beat for beat Star Wars. Every character you meet is just like another like a Bible version of like a George Lucas character. It's stock. The story works. It's a great movie. And I'm done.
The story. We'll go beat for beat on whether it's his best movie, which it might be, because again, I haven't seen Chasing Amy in quite a while, but I remember thinking that was a very good movie. The thing about the Kevin Smith thing that like really doesn't square for me, and I think I'm very much the minority on this one, I find Jason Mewes to be charming. I think Jason Mewes, or Jay, is the best part of all of his movies. I think he's funny. I think he's weird. I know you don't, Phil, and that's why I think I'm very much in the minority. But he reminds me of people I actually know. Now, don't get me wrong. Like, he's certainly the worst. Like, I'm not trying to say he's not the worst and the most problematic guy and like a horrible like wannabe rapist. That's not it. But I find Jason Mewes, who is like basically a drug dealer, who was like Kevin Smith's like drug dealing friend, who he found kind of funny and charming, to be a funny and charming presence in these movies. And as far as like, you know, goofballs on the side, kind of Greek chorusing the Kevin Smith movies, I think that that's a big reason why these movies were and are successful with the people who do like them. Still, I don't like them. Still, I think everything around it is awful. But okay,
I do think that. First of all, I don't necessarily take issue with what you're saying about that. Jason Mewes feels like a real person, just to be clear. He's just not a person I want to spend any time with.
I can tell you right now that the Jason Mewes that you see in those movies is 100% who Jason Mewes is. Because when I was 12, we found out where he lived and trick-or-treated at his house. And it was a group of 12-year-olds all dressed up as like South Park characters. We knocked on his door. He said, "Trick or treat," and then we said "treat," and he showed us 12-year-olds his asshole.
Yeah, okay, cool. That's
and then
cool.
close the door.
That tracks.
I mean, that's who he is.
I mean, he's also, from all accounts.
You're right, Sean. He sucks, and and everything about the movie sucks now.
Well, no, I mean, he's also, you know, Kevin Smith has talked about how he was pretty much high on heroin during the making of this film from beginning to end. So, and this is not, you know, I just want to say that part of the issues that I have with Kevin Smith actually have a lot more to do with like technical stuff. It's like his inability to like cut a scene, you know, like staying in these fucking wides for these long scenes, and it doesn't do him any service. It hurts his scripts. It hurts the performances. You know, the weight that's put on the dialogue when you have these long fucking takes that he doesn't know how to direct the performances out of, it's just, and you're watching two guys. I mean, Ben Affleck and Matt Damon are fucking stars. Like, these guys are bona fide stars. And there's moments where you're just like, dear God, like, how did you make them this bad at times? Like, they're genuinely bad. And, you know, to your point, Kenny, I'm not going to sit here and defend Kevin Smith as a director. But I will say that this is his best film, at least in my humble opinion, because it feels like it means something to him, like genuinely means something. He actually has something to say, whether or not you agree with what he's saying or how he's saying it. This film has some semblance of substance to it. I think Chasing Amy tries that as well, but I've watched that recently and it does not hold up particularly
well. That's interesting. I strongly disagree with what he's saying now, and I think that's not insignificant because it's so smug the way he says it. Every character who has any moral standing, particularly mm-hmm. people like Salma Hayek's character, Alan Rickman's character, Chris Rock's character, you hear it over and over again. It's not how you believe; it's that you believe, right? And I take great issue with anybody telling you any way to believe. I take great issue with people telling you should believe or you shouldn't believe. Don't believe this way, believe this way. Organized religion is bad. Believing on your own is good. I think that ultimately is where I think he takes great pleasure in pointing out how Catholicism is full of hypocrisies and contradictions. I don't take any pleasure in the parlor game of saying that, you know, a religion that's been around for 2,000 years has done some shitty, shitty stuff. A religion that's, you know, that's based on three conflicting books has some stuff in its text that doesn't fly today. I don't think that's particularly cool or clever or revolutionary. And I also don't think it's cool or clever or revolutionary to say, but by the way, you know, you should believe in God, which is really lazy to me also. So I do think that.
But I don't know that the movies. I mean, I guess ultimately, I didn't have the same takeaway that you did. I mean, the takeaway that I got from the film ultimately was, I don't necessarily actually think that he's preaching much of anything other than spirituality. Like, believe in what you want to believe in, and if it gives you guidance and if it makes you feel good, more power to you. That's the impression I got.
Yeah,
but,
as someone who went to a Catholic school, it's the most. And he went to a Catholic school. He went to OLPH. I went to St. Anne's. Basically, Catholic school, it just beats you down with this guilt, and you do rebel against it. And like, it is, it's almost an uneducated, like, I would almost say what I got was an uneducation there. And I assume the same for him. And when it comes to religion, like, he has a lot of ideas and he's trying to share them with the world through this movie. And it is kind of inelegant how he's stating it through all the characters, because all the characters essentially talk exactly the same in Kevin Smith movies, which I would say I would discredit him on that. But like, I do think in terms of like him, his discussion of faith in it, I thought was probably more nuanced than most of the other stuff that happens.
I just don't feel that way. I don't feel that. I feel like this seems like he, to your point, Sean, because I hear that it's well taken. I feel like he spent 17, 18 years getting this uneducation. And then the next period of his life, he was saying all that stuff that happened to me then, all these things I was told is true. That's all lies. And then he never got to the point where he kind of said live and let live. I think this whole, like, it's one thing to do a movie like, which is a brilliant movie, like Spotlight, which is not actually in any way about faith. It's actually about hypocrisy and power and the way systems protect people. And so that's one way to say this church is hiding behind something holy to do unholy things. But it felt, this movie felt very clearly to me, and again, I, you know, the reason I bring up the Salma Hayek character, Albert Brooks character, Chris Rock character, is because they're all moral goods. And the way they over and over again say it's important that you believe, important that you have faith. And I understand the point, which is the idea of it's important to have spirituality, but it's not. By the way, I say that as a spiritual person, but it's not. It's not important.
But I don't think this was an indictment of the Catholic Church as much as because, like, for one, they never talk about child molestation at all. Like, I think what it's more similar to is like how Scorsese has always used Catholic imagery, and it goes back to this weird Catholic guilt. That's, I think, and this is just coming from somebody who was just in therapy an hour ago talking about my Catholic guilt. like, it is so strong. And like, and when you were describing him going like 18 years of uneducation, I'm like, yep, had that. And then what happens is you rebel against it, and then you feel so guilty about rebelling against it that you do make something that is like kind of not hard hitting like Dogma, when you are trying to hit hard and like explain your premise of how you feel about religion. He can't, because it's so complicated and torn up inside. He knows he's not supposed to say there is no God, but he also wants to say there is no God. And it's this like weird convoluted thing. And that's why I think it's a good movie. It's
I think that's fascinating what you just said. I think it's fascinating. I'm more fascinated by the idea that Kevin Smith in my opinion, guts might not be the right word, because it's coming from a different place. You are definitely selling me on the idea that this is a lot more kind of deeply baked in to who he is than that it is an intellectual idea. But he didn't have a problem saying that the Catholic Church was okay with slavery. He didn't have a problem saying that the Catholic Church was okay with the Holocaust. So there were some things that he felt comfortable being like, yeah, you guys are full of shit. But he didn't have the guts to go right at the clergy and right where they live and say, three guys I know were also molested by your, you know, by the
town. Can I just, and I agree with, truthfully, I agree with both of you in this situation. I'm not trying to be a mediator. I'm just trying to say that what I think is interesting about this movie and why I think it is the only movie of his worthy of having this discussion is all of this messiness. Like, I think that this movie is flawed. I'm not going to sit here and necessarily like ride for this movie. We'll talk about obviously the issues I have with it and where we all land in terms of ratings. But I commend the, quite frankly, the confidence and the sort of the drive that it took to get him to make this thing, which obviously was kind of a lightning rod for controversy. It had its issues. It you know, we'll talk about that as well, which led to it being, quite frankly, his most successful film of all time, essentially. I mean, Cop Out was a little more successful, but I think it's a messy, weird fucking thing, and it's a guy working through his issues in a way that is sometimes successful, sometimes not. It is very preachy. There's a lot of monologues. There's a lot of him telling us stuff rather than showing us stuff. But I also think that that's kind of why it's interesting. Like, it's, I think it's an interesting movie.
So the difference is between what I'm saying and what I think you guys are saying, or at least what you're saying, Phil, is I find it fascinating the ways in which he failed, because sure. I think this is a failure, but I think there is some nobility to this failure, but I can't just give him the bonus points because he decided to go after the Catholic Church. Like, frankly, you know, our man fucking who did Boondock Saints kind of did the same thing, right?
Yeah.
So you don't get bonus points just because you put the Catholic Church on trial. But I do think that, like, I think that this is one of the more interesting movies that we're going to do, because usually when we have a movie that elicits this kind of conversation, at the end of it, we sit back and be like, well, any movie that can make us think about this, stuff like this, make us talk this way, is probably a good movie and worthwhile. And which is exactly like what happened with us in Black and White, right? Where we both kind of went into the podcast being like noble failure and ended the podcast by saying worthwhile experience. That's not how I feel about this. whereas Black and White waded into waters that people truly were afraid to wade into. This to me, tiptoed into waters that have been tiptoed into since the beginning of Catholicism. This is like this is where Catholics and Christians. This is where the Protestants came from. The questioning of the values of the church and the tenets of the church have been around for 2,000 years. So I appreciate that he did it, and he's not, you know, just blindly agreeing to everything the Catholic Church told him. But this isn't revolutionary to me. The only reason I do give it credits is because it's aimed at kids, and I mean that because it's aimed at teenagers.
No, I know.
Who probably either felt this way deep down or felt this way at the top of their head and weren't comfortable talking about it like me. And that's why I was, in my way, that's why I appreciated it as a kid. And it's why I appreciate it now.
I think that's why I appreciated it when I saw it in theaters in 1999 was it was like actually outside the box. Cause at the time I was in Catholic school and like, I'm like, wow, this is like another way of thinking while also set with the characters that I'm learning about for an hour each day. But the thing that I appreciated it more about it more last night than previous viewings of it was just in terms of an entertaining movie. I was not expecting it to be kind of just like a fun little romp. It's a fun adventure with like these characters, and like Phil was saying, it's so poorly directed. I got really bored at times with like there's zero camera movement. It's all just it feels like a college kid got a tripod and just is like, I can make a movie in a weekend. At the same time, it is fun, and I'm going to say it right now, I think it might be the first of like the 90s independent directors to do anything really interesting or outside the box.
There's a couple things as you were speaking there that kind of occurred to me. The first was he talked about.
I don't want to drop that last comment though, so keep going.
We'll go back.
No, I'm going to piggyback on it. Because I think that what's interesting is he went to Robert Rodriguez to direct this film. He didn't want to direct it. He had the script. He gave it to Robert Rodriguez and said, "Will you direct this?" Rodriguez said, "You're too close to this. This is a very personal thing for you." And also, quite frankly, might have been like, there's just too much talking in this movie, and I wouldn't even know how to direct this even if I wanted to. But this speaks to this idea of this club, this 90s club of independent filmmakers. And I don't know that there necessarily would have been anyone in that class that would have been like, that would have raised their hand and said they want to do this movie. And I think that says something. Now, to your other point, Sean, about like how poorly directed it is, he wrote this script before Clerks. He did many, many revisions of it for many, many years. But one of the big stumbling blocks for him was he wanted to have enough money to do the effects properly. And I'm just like, what? There's like some wings and a shit monster. Like, I don't know what exactly you needed like special effects for.
Well, you needed a budget. I mean, you know, I don't know if you
sure,
did the first
but you didn't really use it.
I really appreciated the way the wings looked.
The wings looked dope, yeah.
Oh, and you know what also looked great? When they opened the church doors at the end and a light shined on their face. I'm like, he needed money for that.
Here's the thing. It's so
I can pull that off in my child's room right now.
Here's the thing. That's unexpected about this podcast for me. You'll see with my ranking, my before ranking.
Mm-hmm. Your 99 ranking, you mean? Or your before
podcast? No, not my 99, my before the podcast ranking. Because it's so funny. You guys came on, you're like, I didn't hate this movie. I didn't hate this movie, right? But my not hating this movie is like not above a 50 for sure. I truly thought this was one of the worst movies we were going to do. Because I've seen it since, right? I've seen it in the interim quite a bit. Like, again, I thought this was a masterpiece. So like, as like... as I went back to it over the last 20 years and realized, what was I thinking? What was I thinking? What's wrong with me? This is not a masterpiece, and I haven't seen it in probably 10 years. I thought this was going to be one of the worst movies we did. It's not. I'm not trying to say it is. And I didn't give it in single digits or double or, you know, in the teens or 20s or anything absurd like that. So
I covered worse movies with Sean.
No, one of the worst movies, but I never liked that movie. And I guess all I'm really trying to say is, I don't mean to come down on the side of like, this is a piece of trash, because that's not how I really feel.
No, I know.
I just think that like, you guys are giving it too much credit.
It could be. I was exceptionally caught off guard with like how much I did enjoy it. Like
I was too, Sean.
Yeah, I took two negative notes the entire time, and
I took more than that, my friend.
The first was this movie. The setup was great, and it kind of falls off a little bit as soon as Jansel and Bob show up, which I don't think Kevin Smith would like to hear. But like, I was like so immersed in like the beginning of the movie and like finding out about Bethany and like meeting those characters way more than seeing Jay and Silent Bob like talk about fucking and sucking for the next 15 minutes.
I thought the movie actually started pretty weak for me. It's once the actual journey starts and the mission starts that. And maybe that has something to do with the fact that, generally speaking, Kevin Smith movies don't have a journey or a mission, right? Like, it's just a bunch of people sitting around fucking talking, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. But so once the mission starts, I was kind of on board. What hit me up top in the first, like, I want to say 15 minutes when I was just like, fuck, this is going to be a slog and I'm really going to, was the airport scene with Ben and Matt. When I was just like, oh, fuck, is this going to be 2 hours and 8 minutes of just like people on just talking with just like wide shots and just a lot of like.
But not just talking, Phil.
Yeah.
Just, it's not just talking. This is not character building stuff. This is it's talking.
Expo.
It's expo about stuff you don't even really need.
Yeah.
Kevin Smith should have gotten into like stand-up comedy like in the early 90s, and I think it would have saved like a lot of like fat guys in flannel like a lot of grief in their lives if he did do that. But he also probably wouldn't have succeeded. So like, but like, I do think like every single one of his movies, like every character is Kevin Smith riffing the entire time, and I'm just like, I'm glad he found the speaking engagements because he's like so good at that. Like he should have been doing that all along. And this movie is just monologue after monologue after monologue. And some are good and some are really bad. I remember.
Well, he's a good storyteller.
Yeah. I remember as a kid, I auditioned for a school play with the Asriel monologue.
Which one? Not the Holy Bartender. Oh my God.
Holy Bartender is pretty good.
Like, oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Do you know how to make a Holy Bartender? Oh my goodness, guys. Come on. Kevin Smith, the whole thing, having been this guy, I still may be this guy without the weed. And the whole thing has the air of your most annoying stoner friend telling you how it is and being wrong a lot. Like that's and maybe that really is too close to home for me, because I have spent so much time in rooms high just talking at people about the way it is. But being on the other side and not being able to interrupt them, it's so rough. And that's
you know, can I just something just kind of occurred to me in a weird sort of like epiphany, which is that a lot of these 90s independent American filmmakers are all different versions of guys I worked at video stores with. Like they all sort of have that. This might sound worse than it should, but like there's an arrogance to it. There's a Tarantino and a Rodriguez and a Linklater and a Smith, like all these guys that all have, you know, extensive comic book collections and extensive movie collections, and they all think that they know more than everybody else. The difference, of course, is that all those other filmmakers that I just mentioned, are better writers, ultimately. You know what I mean? Like, those people, A, know how to write dialogue better that sound like people. No one sounds like anyone in a Kevin Smith movie. No one. Like, they don't sound like human beings. And yes, there are some funny jokes in there, which is why you stick around, I guess, if you're a fan. But otherwise, it's just, it can be, to your point, Kenny, be very sort of soul deadening, where you're just like, I can't escape this. It's like an onslaught of just the same person, because as you mentioned, Sean, they all sound the same because none of them have any, you know, identifiable voices of their own. So it's a lot.
I do think that is what makes Jay stand out in those movies, though, is he's the only character that feels different than the rest. Like in every single movie, like in Clerks, Dante and Randall are essentially the same. Dante's like a whinier Randall. That's it. They each have one emotion, but they're all Kevin Smith feeling that one emotion.
Sorry, go.
These aren't like that in and of itself isn't a fatal flaw, right? Whenever you think whenever you say something to the effect of this person doesn't sound like people, that in and of itself isn't a fatal flaw. Like every David Mamet movie, they sound like weird robot people.
Sorkin, exactly.
Right. You see their movies all the time that we all like, that where you just kind of go with the world that they're speaking. You can extend that to Josie and the Pussycats. You can extend that to Clueless. There are a lot of movies like that. So it's that coupled with the way it's directed, coupled with the way the actors are directed, coupled with all of this extra fat on this movie that brings it to two hours and 8 minutes. Like I watched Citizen Kane yesterday because, you know, I want to watch Mank and be just up on it. This movie is longer than Citizen Kane.
I will say when I turned on Dogma and I saw that it was 2 hours and 8 minutes, I was noticeably depressed in that moment.
Can I also say that there's a very sort of childish, what? No way that every fucking character has to. Like, everyone's dialed up a little bit too much. Everyone is a little bit too broad. And it's because that's who fucking Kevin Smith is, right? Like, you've seen him and he's excitable and he has this childish kind of, you know, Arrested Development kind of vibe to him, not the show, the trait, that I just kind of, there were just times where, especially with Matt Damon at times, where he just gets goofy, and I just it just really grated on me. I don't really know what to do with this.
Affleck rules, but Damon doesn't really know what to do with this stuff.
Oh, see, I think I disagree so hard, because one of the notes I wrote was Matt Damon is honestly having the most fun he's ever had in this movie. He's having a blast, and it's contagious.
You might be.
Every time he was on, was like, give me more. Give me more of that, David.
I couldn't get over his 90s haircut. Those bangs were just too much for me.
Yeah.
It's incredible that, like, the next time you saw Matt Damon and Ben Affleck together after Good Will Hunting is this movie. This movie is a perfect time capsule of 1999. I think it sums up 1999 cinema, where it's not that great, even though like 99 has some of the best movies ever.
You're right.
So what I was going to say is, it's not that great, but there is some greatness there. And to me, this is the most, it has stars in it. It has like one of the greatest casts ever put together. It's like a yearbook of 1999. It's the who's who in New Hollywood, all in this movie. And to me, it's so in the middle that it actually is the perfect 1999 movie, where it has some greatness, but it also has some terribleness. Like the shit monster, I hate. I don't like shit jokes. When that happened, I like almost fast forward through it. I hated it so much. But it's so in the middle that I appreciate this movie that has so much to say yet says nothing. It's so neutral. It is a neutral movie that also made me happy.
There's so much you just said there.
I know.
I loved every bit of it. I'm going to try to not deal with every part of it so I don't totally filibuster over Phil again. But I want to talk about the Affleck and Damon of it, if that's cool. Yeah. So,
can I just give one bit of context to that?
Yes,
which is that it's not supposed to be Matt Damon. It was originally supposed to be Jason Lee. So he was supposed to be playing Loki. And then
with Affleck.
Sort of a Chasing Amy reunion, I guess. Yeah. And then scheduling got in the way and Jason Lee couldn't do it. And then obviously Good Will Hunting had come out and all of a sudden it became a big deal for him to have. So they get paired together. I don't know what this movie is if it's Jason Lee, quite honestly.
Well, it's probably very similar. I mean, and they were in Mallrats together. And like there is two players, essentially, sure, right? Sure. I always found that. So I guess what happened. Good Will Hunting comes out in 1997. And those guys are the hottest things in the world. Affleck, I believe, does Armageddon in 98. I don't remember exactly what Damon does in 98, but like these guys, they're about two of the biggest stars in the world.
Correct.
Affleck, part of the reason why Affleck had any Hollywood footprint going into Good Will Hunting was because of Mallrats. He was in Mallrats. He was in Dazed and Confused, and he was in Mallrats. And I always thought before I saw Dogma, which I didn't see until home video, actually, but I always thought before I saw Dogma that it was two guys doing a cameo for their friend. And then seeing the movie and seeing that they're actually kind of central to the, not kind of, they're central to this plot, and they have as much or more screen time than anyone, was kind of a shock that made me have to recalibrate exactly what this movie was. This movie no longer could live in the indie sphere once you had two of the biggest movie stars in it. If it was Linda Fiorentino leading this movie with, you know, Alan Rickman and even Chris Rock, you could still call it kind of an indie journey. But once you had those two guys, it became this much bigger thing. And I also think because of that, you have to judge it a little differently. You have to judge it on par with these other movies that were made for this kind of money with those kind of stars.
I mean, truly, the cast is incredible. It's incredible. Wild. It's Linda Fiorentino right after Men in Black. Like a star. Mm-hmm. Affleck, Damon, Chris Rock, Salma Hayek, Alanis Morissette, like just like a year removed from Jagged Little Pill. Right? Or 2 years? Is that 97?
It's a year after her follow-up to Jagged Little Pill.
She meant a lot at that moment.
Yeah. So, I mean, Rickman, Carlin, oh my God. Ethan Sue plays the shit monster. Boo.
Is that true?
That is true. Ethan Suplee does play the shit monster.
Wow.
Because he was part of, like, you know, Kevin Smith's stable. So, yeah, like, and it makes sense. He is a member of the Pussy Posse. If anyone's going to be the shit monster, it's going to be a member of the Pussy Posse.
You know, I really want to do the Pussy Posse draft on Street Drafts. There was a moment, and I still can't really wrap my fucking head around it. Part of it is because Chasing Amy was really well received. And there was this idea that Kevin Smith has grown up. But there is a moment where people, two of the greatest comedians of all time, so two people that anyone who's ever watched comedy respect, two of the hottest actors in the world, some of the hottest actresses in the world, were lining up to work with this man. So what was going on?
Well, there's also the dark cloud over this movie, which is the Weinsteins.
Yeah,
that's why people were lining up to work with Kevin Smith. It wasn't like he was going to make them look good. The only person he makes look good is Chris Rock, who's a bad actor, I think, to begin with.
He is a bad actor.
I also think that we really shouldn't bypass the Good Will Hunting component as well, right? They write that script and they give it to Kevin Smith and they ask him to direct it. And he's smart enough to be like, I can't fucking direct this. Like, you don't want me to direct this. But he does produce it and he does bring it to, obviously brings it to the Weinsteins. And that movie gets, I don't want to say it gets made because of Kevin Smith, but it certainly gets some, you know, wind at its back because of Kevin Smith. I think that also, like, you know, he's in the fucking Weinstein stable, and I'm sure that they want to help him get this passion project. This is ultimately, like, the movie he's wanted to make since he wanted to make movies. So I respect that they get behind him and they help him make it. And to your point, like, Ben Affleck's in this thing. It's after Good Will Hunting. Like, there's a lot of things kind of working to its benefit in terms of getting this cast together. They still only get $10 million for the budget. It's not like he gets a shit ton of money to make this thing.
No pun.
Yeah, he's one of Weinstein's, I think, two success stories. There's Quentin, obviously.
Yeah.
And there's Kevin Smith. And almost everything else Weinstein did was just that of note was just Oscar chasing. Dimension notwithstanding, right? Yeah. Like, Dimension's its own kind of thing.
But he was really, more Bob than Harvey, if I'm not mistaken.
It was more Bob than Harvey, who gets a pass for also being a monster. But
apparently, but, yeah.
But yeah, so yeah. It that is a weird thing for the Kevin Smith component of it, that, you know, he, and I don't know if he had, does he ever talk about the fact that was a big part of his career?
I think he made a comment about how he didn't know or something like that was going on, which is clearly a lie. The saddest part to me, as somebody who does have a soft spot for Kevin Smith, is he never made a movie that was even remotely good without Harvey Weinstein. So no matter what, all of his like movies that people even liked were now under a dark cloud.
Well, what's interesting too is he talked about recently, actually, that there was talk of a sequel. Harvey Weinstein apparently called him up about a week before the New York Times article was about to drop, and called him up and said, we should do a Dogma sequel. And Kevin was like, I mean, I don't really know what that is, but I mean, I guess I can chew on it for a bit. And then a week later, obviously, the news comes out, and he thinks that Harvey just called him to see if, like, Kevin Smith still thought they were friends. You know what I mean? Like, that it was just a last sort of, you know, am I a monster? Do you still think I'm a monster? I don't know, something like that.
Will you sit behind me at my trial?
Oh yeah. Also probably like seeing if anyone has reached out to Kevin to mm-hmm. give a comment. Cause he knew a week, he probably definitely knew this was coming.
Yeah.
So like,
There's the money of it too, right? Which is that if you know, Harvey's also like, if I can weather this storm, this had a big cast, and if I can pull these people together again, there's money to be, like, it felt like there was money to be made if I can somehow get through this.
That was such a weird call. Like,
oh yeah.
20 years later, Harvey Weinstein calls out of the blue and says, I got a pitch for you. Dogma 2. What do you think? I'm sure Kevin Smith should have known that Harvey Weinstein was like going away.
Yeah.
He should have
I'm going to give a synopsis for the people who haven't seen Dogma. Two fallen angels who were ejected from paradise find themselves banned in Wisconsin. They're now headed for New Jersey, where they find a loophole that can get them back into heaven. The only catch is they will destroy humanity. A group bands together to stop them, written and directed, obviously, by Kevin Smith. Dogma opened on November 12th, 1999, in third place with $3 million behind Pokemon, the movie, and The Bone Collector. But it did beat The Messenger and Anywhere But Here. So there you go. It would go on to make $44 million on a $10 million budget. It's the highest grossing film in Smith's View Askewniverse series. It's got 67% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 85% from audiences. I'm going to read a brief chunk of Roger Ebert's 3.5 out of 4-star review of this film. Kevin Smith has made a movie that reflects the spirit in which many Catholics regard their church. He has positioned his comedy on the balance line between theological rigidity and secular reality, which is where so many Catholics find themselves. He deals with eternal questions in terms of flawed characters who live now, today, in an imperfect world. Is the film less than perfect? It is, because Smith is too in love with his dialogue. Like George Bernard Shaw, I'm sure that's a comparison that's made often, he loves to involve his characters in long, witty conversations about matters of religion, sexuality, and politics. Dogma is one of those rare screenplays like Shaw that might actually read better than it plays. Smith is a gifted comic writer who loves paradox, rhetoric, and unexpected zingers from The Blind Side. Those whose approach to religion is spiritual have little trouble with Dogma, because they will understand the characters are imperfect, sincere, clumsy seekers trying to do the right thing. Those who see religion more as a team, a club, a hobby, or a pressure group are going to be upset. This movie takes theological matters out of the hands of spokesmen and entrusts them to, well, the unwashed, and goes as far as to suggest that God loves them and as a Canadian. It surprises me not one bit that it's a Canadian, since he's obsessed with Canada. I couldn't tell you why. I think he just likes Canadian accents or something.
It's 100% Degrassi, because like I remember like it was always on PBS, and I love Degrassi too. And he references it heavily in Chasing Amy.
He does.
That's what it is.
Ebert's review is interesting. I think that I remember this getting good reviews. It's funny. I think this movie actually also kind of was weirdly an Oscar player. Before it came out, I do think that there was this idea that this might be Kevin Smith's Oscar movie, which, you know,
like a screenplay nomination, something like that.
If everything aligns the right way, like, again, Chasing Amy was considered really good, and Clerks was also considered really good and also considered kind of revolutionary.
Yep.
So I do think there was a ton of goodwill towards Kevin Smith. And to Sean's earlier point, this is, even though it's, you know, within the Viewersk universe, this is outside of the lane, as was Chasing Amy. Like, dealing with LGBTQ issues back then for a stoner bro, and again, what seems like a somewhat sensitive way for the time, don't really remember. He did push forward, and he is non-judgmental, and he is clearly a pretty fucking decent guy. Like, I think that Kevin Smith's like general kindness, compassion, decency comes through in almost everything he does. And I think the only thing holding Kevin Smith's movies back are his ability to tell the stories cinematically. Mm-hmm. And I also think he, you know, as Ebert said, as you said, Phil, like, it's not, to me, it's not an editing thing in post. It's an editing thing on the page. Like,
oh, sure,
cut
sure.
those conversations down. You do not need a 130-page script here.
Yep. I think it's also interesting that this film was controversial. Like, not to be glib, but like, really? The church got all up in arms about a movie that has a shit demon?
Yeah, that's the Catholic Church. They don't want any media to reference them or anything. They've always been that way. It's insane. Because I remember like going to see this movie and my mom being like, "But the church said you shouldn't go see this." Like, I very much remember that conversation. I'm like, I don't care. I really don't care. Like, I'm gonna go. It's Kevin Smith, the voice of my generation.
He also courted it, right? He wanted it. That was obvious from the definition of disclaimer, followed by the disclaimer, which I despise with every bone of my body.
I did actually think, like, when I read the, I remember reading it as a 14-year-old being like, that's funny. And then last night I was so annoyed at that platypus joke that I was like, I didn't take a note, but I was just like, that's so fucking lame.
I don't know, man. And the whole thing feels like, you know what that feels like to me? It's kind of like that joke, which is an amazing joke, in Batman, when Joker puts on the glasses before Batman's going to hit him and says, "You wouldn't hit a guy with glasses." Whole thing feels like, it feels like Kevin Smith being like, I'm just a bro from Jersey, went to Catholic school, got some thoughts, going to put them into this movie. Just don't judge me too harshly, man. And fuck you, man. I'm judging you real harshly. You spent $10 million here. You put it out in fucking 2,000 screens. You got to act like a Damon. You cannot pretend to just be a guy sitting on a couch who has some thoughts about this shit. And I think that's kind of where my this weird vitriol I have is coming from. I do think he's just acting as if like it's not a big deal that I'm putting this out there. Well, it is. Like, it is a big deal. Stop hedging. I don't appreciate like the final viewpoint. I think it's like, I think it's to me like the most kind of the simplest view of life on Earth, which is just believe however you want. But I understand he's coming from it from a different point of view, where for 18 years he was told, no, you have to believe this exact way or else we'll see you in hell, motherfucker.
You know what I found myself thinking a lot about as I was watching this film was Preacher and This Is Not the End, and kind of Seth Rogen in general a little bit. And,
this is and, the end.
This is the end. Sorry.
Yeah.
The sort of the, quite frankly, how much smarter Seth Rogen stuff is than Kevin Smith, and the intellectualism that exists underneath what seems like a goofy exterior, and how rich those movies are, how much better directed those movies are. This isn't me just sitting here saying that Seth Rogen is great, but it's like there's a crossover. There's a Venn diagram between those two guys. And in a world where Kevin Smith could evolve as a filmmaker and evolve as a writer, he might have been able to actually get into that category, but he never does.
That is true. And it also, there is the, like, when Kevin Smith made Zach and Miri make a porno, like, Seth Rogen was always talking about, like, what an influence Kevin Smith was on him. The thing that separates them is Seth Rogen is smarter, obviously, but then yes. On top of that, he is kind of like an actual film student, like where he is, you know, like constantly learning, and he kind of used every piece of the Buffalo to get him to where he is. And I feel like Kevin Smith, because Clerks worked after him going to film school for a month and dropping out and just getting a bunch of credit card debt, you don't learn that way. like that's not how you learn. It was an accidental success. And once you have that accidental success, it's not like they do now and where, like, if you have a hit indie movie, you all of a sudden direct a Hulu show and, like, learn the steps to actually direct. They just gave him a big budget comedy in Mallrats and it fucking blew up in his face. So then he had to make another indie movie that accidentally worked. And like, my heart goes out to Kevin Smith because like he was afforded opportunities that I don't think would happen nowadays because of like him being an unexceptional white man. But at the same time, he was given these opportunities and it did work for a little bit and then it just didn't anymore. And that's like kind of heartbreaking because he has a huge fan base. Like he could theoretically be making movies to the day he dies, but like he just like lost it. And I feel for him.
I actually think that Zach and Miri feels like the moment that it got away from him. Like that felt like, I remember when that script came out. I remember when, I mean, cause I, you know, I think Kenny and I might've both been at UTA around that time, if I'm not mistaken.
2005. Yeah. I think it was pretty, yeah, it was right when I would be back.
And I remember it being a big deal. I remember people being like, this is it. This is the moment when this is the ascension. This is when he finally breaks out of the view askew bullshit, quote unquote bullshit. Although there is kind of some crossover there, but my point is, that I remember seeing that in the theater and being like, he's still a bad filmmaker. Like he still hasn't learned anything. And had that been the chance, I mean, who knows what could have been possible, but you know, now we are where we are.
I think there's another view, askew of this, which is he lived the dream. Like this is the, what he did, he lived the dream and continues to live the dream, mm-hmm. right? Like what he did with having four consecutive movies and then several after that, that built this world, which was essentially the world he grew up in with some weird supernatural elements, bringing in everything he's ever thought of, is everything you could ever hope for as a kid who's obsessed with like dick jokes and Star Wars. And I don't mean that. I don't really mean that derisively. No, like he had the most charmed career. Got to make more than eight movies, right? He probably got to make 12 movies, something like that.
Yeah. So you have, I think I can list them. Clerks, Mallrats, Chasing Amy, Dogma, Jane, Silent Bob, Strike Back, Jersey Girl, Clerks 2, Zach and Miri Make a Porno, Red State, Tusk, Yoga Hosers, and Jay and Silent Bob Reboot.
So,
Cop Out.
So 14 movies, and he could, and I think he can make a movie tomorrow if he wanted to. He certainly could make a low budget movie, but this isn't. I guess what I'm saying is, like, this isn't M. Night Shyamalan. Where M. Night Shyamalan, I think, really is what you said, Sean. Like, he had it, like no one ever had it, and he blew it because of his own hubris and, you know, reading his own fucking press clippings and getting over his skis. Kevin Smith never really did that. He just kind of did what he can do over and over and over again. There's enough people who are kind of like charmed or interested in what he does. I think that, like, to me, there's a strong Jersey thing going on there. Whereas, you know, like, we have a lot of filmmakers, particularly around our area, a little older than us, from the New England, Boston area. You have high, you have medium, you have low. You have a lot of people kind of repping for that area. There aren't a lot of people repping for Jersey the way he does, particularly this low class kind of way. And I understand, like, and this is I'm from Westchester, Long Island, the South Philly, the South Jersey, the Philadelphia area. This does feel like home to me in its own way. Even Clerks, as much as like I felt like, what am I watching? I got it, right? Like, I got what I was looking at. So I think that there's a lot, and always will be a lot of built up goodwill for what he does and what he has done. And I think what I am bringing to this conversation is unusual for a somewhat very unremarkable, overweight white Jew from the tri-state area to just look at this stuff and just be like, this is garbage. I think is unusual.
I think so. Cause I mean, I remember when there were like vulgar thons in Red Bank, like every year, where it was basically a marathon that he would host of all of the View Askew movies. And like people would line up and like the city was taken over. It's a very small town, but taken over by Kevin Smith fans. And they all look alike. They are all like kind of thinning hair, like skullets. Like they look like Kevin Smith. Like he created an army of himself. And yeah, everyone who looked like that loved Kevin Smith. And I was a fat 12-year-old and I loved Kevin Smith because, like, not even just because he was a hometown boy, but like it was interesting to see somebody who had like the same background as me do it. Like he showed you that it was possible.
Making the same kind of jokes.
Yeah.
Like there is, like, again, I think like fucking like Clerks never worked for me, but like what did work for me was like I loved the fucking Death Star thing. Like that, there was something about that monologue from that guy that was like, this is the kind of shit I talk about. No one ever would have the guts to put this in a movie. Now looking back, it's so tortured and exhausting to sit and watch that guy deliver that monologue so stupidly. But at the time, I felt like, yeah, this is my kind of shit. So I don't know. It's weird. I have no more affinity for this movie, but I have a lot more affinity for the man.
I think I just want to give a little bit more context in terms of how this film kind of came to be. It was supposed to be released in November of 98, but Disney bought Miramax. They got cold feet. They were a little worried about it. Miramax bought the film in its entirety back from Disney, released it through Lionsgate in 99. I guess you can take that for what it's worth. I guess to Kevin's perspective, it must be great that the Weinsteins backed the movie in the way that they did. Kevin Smith on the DVD commentary talks about Linda Fiorentino was very difficult to work with and that on some days she wouldn't even speak to him. And then in retrospect, he wished he offered the role to Janine Garofalo.
I thought the same thing. She was difficult to watch. She was really bad in this movie.
Oh, I don't agree. But I thought she was fine. I thought she was absolutely fine. I mean, she wasn't. She did as well as anyone can do in a Kevin Smith movie.
Janine Garofalo would have been so much better, would have brought something to it. Every scene she was in, it was like she hated every moment she was in.
Well, but I also feel like that's kind of Linda Fiorentino's vibe. She always looks like she doesn't want to fucking be there. I mean, all of her roles are disgruntled, angry people.
not, first of all, that's not true. But second of all, like, that's not a fucking, that's not a good characteristic if you wanted an actor. Janine Garofalo would have been a lot of fun, and I would have liked watching that movie a lot more.
I think that it's interesting that after he had his heart attack, in an interview, he said that she called him up after he had his heart attack to see if he was okay. He apologized to her and said that he never should have said what he said about her, and that, you know, he appreciated that. My point is, they mended any bridges. He felt sorry that he'd ever said the things that he said, and he was happy.
Oh, she's Catholic. It should have been Janine Garofalo. Sorry.
Alanis Morissette was originally offered the role of Bethany Sloan, but she couldn't do it.
That would have been terrible
because of her world tour. But then he offered it to but his first choice was Gillian Anderson. The role of God was originally written for Holly Hunter. That's why the piano line is still in there. You know, I don't know what this movie is with Gillian Anderson as Bethany. I think that's bizarre as well. But I mean,
no, I think you do need a Janine Garofalo or Linda Fiorentino. You need somebody who seems angry at the world. That's the whole purpose of this character, Bethany. She's Kevin Smith's angry side. She's the only angry character in the entire movie.
You also need that droll sense of humor, right? That can take the piss out of it. Otherwise, like it, I think it would. Kenny, I'm not saying Janine Garofalo might not have been better. I love Janine Garofalo. I'm certainly not shitting on her. I guess I'm just saying that I like Linda Fiorentino. I like the energy that she brings, and there's a.
Oh.
It didn't bother me.
I don't know. The way she's obviously the protagonist of this movie, and she did almost literally nothing actually that made me sympathize or empathize with her on her journey.
What about the time she ran off into the water and cried?
the scene with her and Ben Affleck when they're on the train and they're both talking about. I actually like that scene.
That was great.
Where they're both talking about what it's like to be left, what it's like to be, you know, what faith means in another person. I thought that was a really nice scene. They apparently had a deleted scene that was at the end of the film that actually really would have clarified for me, which is she shows up dead and you don't know how she got injured, Bethany, at the end of the film.
When she unplugs God, like she gets hit with like a lightning bolt.
Something happens, but I thought it was more. I thought it was
and it like cuts her stomach.
I thought it was more like a stigmata-ish thing, but whatever. Go ahead, Phil. But yes, I know when she got hurt. I didn't know how.
The long story short, apparently the shit demon and one of the triplets that's been decomposing shows up at the hospital and Bob has a big fight with this monster and then the monster injures her and that's how she has this gash in her side.
Shit monster comes back?
That didn't happen.
Yeah.
Shit monster comes back.
After they handled it with one of the worst jokes in movie history.
The joke?
Kills the all aerosol. Odor. Yeah.
Oh, it's so bad.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I'm just telling you how it is. These are the things that were there that could have happened. They didn't happen. Whether the film is better or worse for it, we can obviously discuss that. But I feel like
Kenny swayed me, by the way. I feel like I'm now on Kenny's side.
This is, by the way, I'm on Kenny's side. I'm not going to fucking rave about this movie. I have a better rating than you do, probably, Kenny. But like, we went into this with you loved this movie as a kid. And I didn't. So I went into this from a space of, well, I didn't like this then. I'm not going to like it now. So it went up a little bit in my esteem. Whereas for you, you just went through an existential, like, why did I ever like this?
No, it mirrors I went through that like 10 years ago. But it kind of mirrors my own kind of like spiritual evolution. Right? Like at 17, this was where I was. You know, and it's not Catholicism, it's Judaism, but it's the same kind of idea, right? Yep. It's the same idea of like being brought up in a religion is really unsettling. It's unsettling to have these people essentially tell you that these things that we can't prove are the truth. And that's horrifying. I hated that feeling as a kid. But as I've gotten older, it's not even on some like, you know, whatever makes you happier, you know, religion is better or worse. I am very much on some like, no fucking clue what's happening. I don't know what's going on in the world. Like I could, anything could be right, anything could be wrong, and like having any kind of judgment whatsoever is crazy to me. Right? But like I still like yeah. I'm still not raising them in a religion. That's still some shit that like, you know, kind of gives me the willies.
I would like my kids to know where they came from and then let them make a decision whether or not religion means something to them.
Than religious
yeah.
to me.
Yes. But, yeah. But I mean, all of this is to say that weirdly, I watched this film and I hate to even utter this in the same sentence as Dogma, but I thought about Angels in America, which I love.
Yeah.
And I couldn't help but sort of think about, I like magic realism. I like what he was doing with it. I like that he infused his own Kevin Smithness into this type of arena. I don't think it's entirely successful. I'd say most of it isn't successful, but it didn't seem like a religious movie to me. I don't know. I mean, maybe that's just because I just didn't see it that way. But I mean,
I think why I thought it worked last night, and I've already mentioned it kind of, but to me, as somebody who understands that Kevin Smith loves comic books and stuff, this is his most comic book-esque movie 100%. He's ever made. And you could actually see that because it's like one of his only movies that has a story. It has like a real story, and it moves. It does move. It doesn't feel like 2 hours and 8 minutes, despite seeing that and getting upset. You will get upset when you see 2 hours and 8 minutes. I can't change that about the movie. But it does work. The story works, and it actually kind of, it does, you do get swept away. There are elements that swat you away to try to get you to stop caring, like the ship monster. And some of Jay's lines really just, they stand out in 2020 as being
yeah,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, this sucks. And also, like, that's the same thing that happens when you go back and see Chasing Amy. It's like
it's
progressive in 1997 is cringy in 2020.
And I also think Serendipity being a stripper doesn't age well either.
Oh, at no. all? Yeah, no, it's rough.
neither do the Bloods who are, you know, sitting there watching across the catwalk from yeah. our guys.
Oh, Tara, the just. Really awful.
There are a lot. I mean, go ahead, Chuck.
He does not know how to write black characters, but yet tries to, and a lot, especially yeah. Chasing Amy and Dogma.
So he doesn't. I mean, like it's there's that shit. I mean, I don't. You know, I the part of the reason that I don't really care about what Jay is doing or saying is because Jay's a buffoon. Right, like Jay is a complete clown in this movie. He's meant to be a complete clown. No one takes him seriously. Everyone thinks he's an idiot. And I like his delivery because he reminds me of real people. But there are a lot of kind of cringy decisions made in this movie. That's not really why I think the movie doesn't work. I don't know, Phil. Do you wanna go through the synopsis? I feel like got a writing for the way the movie works, and let's see what happens.
I mean, we have hit a fair amount of the plot, but essentially, you know, the movie opens, Fallen Angels, Bartleby, Loki. They're basically talking about how they figured out a loophole in order to get into heaven is to get into this church in New Jersey. I kind of dug the very, very beginning is these teenage hockey demons essentially beating the shit out of Bud Cort I think it's Jersey. Is it Jersey?
Yeah, it's okay. Asbury Park, baby.
And then we meet Bethany Sloan, played by Linda Fiorentino. She works at an abortion clinic. She is then visited by Metatron.
It's Megatron. Not Megatron. I'm kidding. not to jump ahead.
Yeah.
Okay. What is going on in the scene with Bud Cort? Like, maybe I just don't understand.
The end scene or the first scene?
Well, those are the only two scenes he's in, right? So,
yeah, correct.
So this man, because it's man who is, you know, Bud Cort is Bud Cort, but the only reason I know Bud Cort is because he was a 17-year-old in Harold and Maude, not this 300-year-old he somehow was 25 years later.
He's also an asshole in Heat. That's the only other thing that I know him.
So yeah. Bud Cort is on the boardwalk, and these three hockey-playing demons with dead eyes just kind of attack him. And then at the end of the movie, we find out that his body is where God is stuck. What's happening here?
Okay, so God, I think if you meet God or communicate with God, your head explodes. Mm-hmm. So she likes skee ball. So she takes on a different look to play skee ball. That way she can interact with people. And all 90s filmmakers grew up loving Harold and Maude and felt bad for Bud Cort, so they would cast him in 90s movies.
Kenny, I think from a logistical perspective, from a story perspective or plot, the impression I got was God likes skeetball, as Sean just said. When the hockey players attack him, they trap God inside this body. They don't kill him, but they knock him unconscious so that he can't escape. Again, why God can't escape, because who the fuck knows? But he's imprisoned in that body so that fucking Ben and Matt can then destroy the world.
I think those two things are not necessarily connected.
They are connected because Jason Lee is using trapping God in that body as an opportunity to destroy the universe through Ben and Matt. He's the one that sent them the newspaper article.
All right. So here's the question, I guess. How much of George Carlin rededicating this church was part of a plan, or was it part of or was it just serendipity that it happened to happen? See, that's the part that I think – that's what I was getting at when these two things like aren't at – because in order for this plan to work, a church has to also rededicate itself.
They're waiting for that moment.
Exactly. Yeah. Jason Lee sees that Carlin's doing this and sees that as the opportunity to seize upon it.
It also – this movie's so exhausting. I don't even know why I'm doing this. It also made enough sense to me because you can ignore this stuff, which is fine too, but it also it also implies that the Catholic Church does have a direct line to God, where if you do rededicate a church, it actually has some kind of ecclesiastical purpose. Where you see what I'm saying? Not only that, later George Carlin, we find out he blesses his golf clubs. He's just the kind of asshole who will bless his golf clubs. So anything that he blesses then has the power to kill a demon. I think that this is a shortcut. That's what I'm getting.
It might be, but I do think this is also like universal monster rules at that point. Like where like priests can bless anything that could kill a Dracula as well.
Except Dracula isn't also about how organized religion is bullshit. So like to then say, you know, the guy who's in charge of organized religion or this particular like branch of this organized religion actually does have a direct line to God and the ability to bless anything that therefore then is holy and can kill a demon does seem like a shortcut that undercuts the premise of this movie, the central argument. That's, again, don't know why I'm doing this. Can't help myself.
So at this point, Metatron shows up, appears to Bethany, tells her that she is, what is she like? She's somehow related to Jesus.
The last sign. She is Jesus' great niece, because Joseph and Mary, after she had sex with God, then she had sex with Joseph a lot. And they had brothers and sisters.
So,
which I can get on board with, by the way.
She's told that the two prophets are going to help her and she needs to stop these angels and save the universe. She's about to be killed by those fucking hockey demons when Jay and Silent Bob show up and they are the two prophets. here's another thing that Kevin Smith does very poorly: directing action. He is really bad at it. It has no energy whatsoever. It's cut like shit. It's just bad. But anyway.
It's easily, he's 15 years behind, especially like in that train sequence when he's throwing them out of the train. I'm like, they mastered this in like the 20s.
Yeah.
How are you doing this in 1999? It looks so bad.
It's shocking. I mean, here's the other thing that I think we all can attest to, especially now in this, you know, franchise tentpole culture that we live in movies. So many of these movies now, the below the line is on rails, right? Like a Marvel movie is on rails. And you've got all these people. And it's not to take away from the directors, but like so much of it now is working. How he didn't have a competent below the line to just say, hey, Kevin, like, stay out of the way. I got this. I'm your second unit, and I'll do your fucking action is shocking to me.
You know why, Phil? Because we haven't mentioned this. This is the biggest blank check movie, even though it's only $10 million, we will ever get. Because it is. Because this is the movie, more than any movie I've ever seen, where no one said exactly what you're talking about. Because it extends. Blank check movies usually are just, I'm going to shoot what I want. But I've earned it because I'm really good.
Yep.
The thing is, and when you're talking about the train sequence, the weird thing I started thinking about was, you guys have seen Spice World, right?
Sure. Uh-huh.
Remember when they do the quote-unquote train jump? Yeah. I mean, the bus jump? And they cut to a toy tiny bus?
Yeah,
like a
toy bus.
And it's lovely and charming and hilarious and it's wonderful. He doesn't have the sense of humor about himself as a filmmaker to find charm in his inability to do the big things right. So he tries to do the big things as well as he could possibly do them. And sometimes they look pretty good. Like, I think the wings look amazing. And I especially think the broken wings look amazing. But after flying around and dropping people from 300 feet, it's sub-birdemic, you know? So I do think that this is a real Kevin Smith essentially saying, stay the fuck off my set. I got it.
Yeah. I also do think, he was loyal to a fault with the people he worked with. People like his crew that he had on Clerks came with him. Like Dave Klein was a cinematographer who now is the DP on The Mandalorian and can actually shoot stuff. But his, if you look at his IMDb, his first movies are Clerks, Mallrats, Chasing Amy, Dogma, in consecutive. And then he didn't work outside of that world. So he was learning on the job. Kevin Smith was learning on the job. And that is just not the way to make things that are
$10 million.
But one of them learned. The other one didn't. Yeah.
Kevin Smith should be writing Howard the Duck cartoons for the rest of his life. That's where he is.
But to Sean's point, because you talked about how there were the indie directors who wind up on Hulu shows and really people kind of get to cut their teeth within systems that are already working. You know, we've all worked on TV shows. You know, the joke is the only entry level position on a TV crew is director, which is true. Anyone can walk into a TV show. Anybody can walk into a TV show and be a competent director because the systems are set up for you to succeed. It looks like Dave Klein did the same thing with television, where Dave Klein got to go. And, you know, again, DP is not exactly the same as director, but again, you are set up to succeed as a episodic DP in a way that you're not on an indie film.
Yeah, I mean it's everything that I agree with everything both of you are saying. Like for what you're saying, Kenny, in terms of the fact that he's been given this golden opportunity to be able to, you know, he's given a blank check. He gets to do what he wants to do, and you know, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. So at this point, Bethany and the prophets are joined by Rufus, the 13th apostle, played by Chris Rock, and Serendipity, played by Salma Hayek. Then we have this really clunky boardroom scene with Ben and Matt, where they're yelling at these at a boardroom filled with CEOs and business types about corporate greed and all the terrible things that that corporate America has done. So apparently, this was supposed to be like a John Woo type action sequence, which is why all these guys at this boardroom are in fucking like, they're stunt guys. They're all like built guys. But then at the last second, he decided to not do that. So it's staged and blocked really poorly. And again, not to belabor the point, but it's so fucking talky. And like his initial instincts were right. If he turned it into a fucking John Woo type action sequence, I might have had more interest, even though I think he probably doesn't know how to direct that.
And then on top of that, like, if you don't do it the John Woo way, at least build tension with the directing. And the tension is not built, like, at all. Like, here he is, like, an angel is going into a boardroom and revealing everyone's secrets, and it just plays flat the entire time. Yeah. Like, there's no emotion, like, other than, like, the CEO, which, by the way, also, whoever found that boardroom, it doesn't look like a major corporation's boardroom. It's poorly set designed and all that. Like, everything that could go wrong went wrong. But but to not do this action sequence, there's zero tension. I don't care if those characters live or die. It's not a big moment for Loki. It's such a bad scene. Which should be great. It should be a great scene. Like, it has all of the elements. Like, yeah. Matt Damon's selling the shit out of it. And, like, that thing with the onion and doing... doesn't go anywhere. Nothing goes anywhere.
And again, just to be a baby, Kevin Smith is telling me that he has problems with corporate America? Yeah. This guy who worships at the altar of Marvel and DC is telling me that, like, people who sell fast food to kids should be murdered? Now, I'm not saying that they shouldn't, but I am saying that it's a really boring and trite argument for someone to make out of nowhere. It's the kind of argument you make just to score points when he actually isn't in any way investigating why he feels that way or why these characters feel that way. And then on top of that, Sean, just to bring it back to like your other podcast with us or one of your other two podcasts, what is the Catholic obsession with righteous kills? Because Boondock is about righteous killing. And this movie, these two characters, now granted, these two characters are played as evil and they deserve credit for that. But there is this idea that like you sin, you die.
Well, that is what you are told your entire life is anything. It doesn't matter what the sin is. If you do not ask for forgiveness from God, you die and you deserve it. Yeah, you go to hell and burn for eternity. But the beauty of Catholicism is you can kill somebody and then ask for forgiveness and you're still allowed to enter heaven and sit by. So that's this like weird fantasy of a particular type of Catholic guy is that they can murder and get away with it.
I guess like to Kevin Smith's credit, and again, like he plays that as that's about the worst thing you could do or be. You know, like every Jew, I don't know if you've had this, Phil, but every Jew has played the little game in their mind, which is like, so you're telling me if I fast on Yom Kippur, I'll be absolved of all my sins? And then it doesn't matter what I did. If I die that night, I go straight to heaven. That's pretty good. Maybe I'll just kill myself that night or run in front of traffic. So I do understand that dream of being able to do whatever you want to do. I don't understand. Like this is the difference. This is why this movie is worthwhile. That Boondock Saints is a heaping pile of shit. Because Boondock Saints is clearly like, you know, it's like the filmic arm of the worst impulses of Catholicism.
Yeah, like if Boondock Saints was made now, the Boondock Saints would be killing the people the priest molested for tempting those poor priests.
Right, that's right.
So at this point, they're on the they see the fucking, they kill the shit demon, that thing shows up. So then they're on the train. Bob throws the angels off the train after Bartleby tries to kill Bethany. here's a question. Kicks the guy off the train and then says, no ticket. Is that a Last Crusade reference?
I believe it is. And I, as I was watching it last night, I was like, it doesn't make sense at all. Like, it's just like, anyway. Like Silent Bob, who never talks, chooses to just say a line from a movie he likes in this life or death situation.
Yeah.
It just, it doesn't make sense.
We're now at the point where they realize that if they can convince George Carlin to not do the celebration, then the angels can't get into the church and all will be averted. But of course, George Carlin is not having any of that because he's a capitalist, I guess.
I think that was the realest moment about Catholicism. Man, that's where he really nailed it.
Catholicism, we haven't talked about two things. We haven't talked about Catholicism, wow, which is funny.
Yeah.
And Buddy Jesus, which is kind of a meme. And I actually, Buddy Christ, I mean. And I actually, I think Buddy Christ is kind of funny too, in its own way.
Buddy Christ is very funny. And also, like the thing about it being sad is like that, that's like pretty good. Like he steals a Bill Hicks joke and then improves upon it with Buddy Christ.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, that, yeah, honestly, yeah, Buddy Christ works.
Yeah, Buddy Christ is all right.
Yeah, but truth be told, I liked George Carlin in this movie, even though in a weird sort of way, which I think speaks to Kenny's point earlier, he kind of doesn't belong in this movie in a weird way. Like, he actually hurts. He helps the plot. He hurts the thesis.
The 100.
Yes.
Yeah. And also it is a stunt casting at that time, like to cast George Carlin as a, like a, he's a bishop, right? Or a cardinal. He's a cardinal.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's like, can you believe our preeminent atheist comedian is playing a cardinal? Like,
but I think Carlin and Chris Rock are the kind of stunt casts that elevate your movie really high. Getting the seal, the comedy seal of approval from people like them, who I think basically, you know, Sean, we talked to you about having you on for some big stand-ups this year. And
which I still want to do very much, though.
Yeah. Two of the biggest stand-up shows, the biggest stand-up, I guess, the sets or acts or whatever, were Carlin had a thing and Chris Rock had a thing. Like, they were still two of the biggest stand-ups in the world at the time, probably along with Seinfeld. And having them, those guys who don't act a lot in your movie, kind of meant that, like, this is to be taken as seriously as possible from a comedic standpoint.
100%. Yeah. I mean, like, even then, I would say they were probably top five, and they are still top five of all time now.
I would say top five working then and now. I mean, if someone said they were their one and two, I don't think you would think any less of that.
No. So yeah, to have that actually is giving some, like, hey, look, like, Kevin Smith is a great comedy writer. He got two of the funniest people on the planet to say this script is a complete shit.
Yeah. I would also say too, Chris Rock is one of those guys that can almost make anything funny.
Yes, almost. And he's almost. But and what? Why? I think Chris Rock is very good in this movie, where he kind of wasn't in other movies of the late '90s. Like, I remember seeing like Nurse Betty and being kind of disappointed by him.
That's a weird movie too. Like,
yeah. Kevin Smith is giving him bits to do. So he's just doing stand-up the entire movie. Like, every single thing he does is a bit. Some of it is cringy. Like, I could go for a two-piece and a biscuit is a problematic line to give to probably one of the funniest people ever to say, never mind a black comic.
Yeah, I mean, Chris Rock works in this film because he's kind of just being, to your point, he's just being Chris Rock, right? Like, he's doing bits and he's giving him just, you know, monologues, and Chris Rock's delivery is always funny. Like, even if he's delivering bad dialogue, the way he delivers it inherently is funny.
Yes, agreed.
I don't know why he's there. I don't really understand why Ruth is chopping. But that's neither here nor there. I like this deployment of Chris Rock, which is a little different than a lot of other top stand-ups are used. When you put a guy in your movie who's known for being a cerebral stand-up, be it a Carlin or a Chris Rock or a Chappelle or almost any cerebral stand-up who's not like kind of clowning over there, Eddie Murphy even, they're almost always high-status guys, smartest guy in the room. And it's not that Chris Rock isn't high status or smartest guy in the room, but he is not leading this journey. He's like kind of the buddy. And there's something very endearing about the Chris Rock of this movie. He's got kind of a brother-sister thing going on with Linda Fiorentino. I completely trust him from a moral and ethical place. It's probably my favorite use of Chris Rock in a movie ever, which is a real weird thing to say, but he makes really – horrible movies. I've never seen Top Five. It's apparently pretty good.
No, I think you are right. Like, because I've seen a huge portion of Chris Rock's filmography. Like, and this is probably one of his strongest outings in terms of like. It's playing to his strength. It's playing to his strength, and he is kind of knocking it out of the park. When he has to like do like love scenes and stuff, that's where I think he gets like awkward and fumbly.
He's actually quite good in this new season of Fargo, showing another sort of tool that he has in his tool belt that I'm not sure I knew he had. He can be pretty menacing, and he can have sort of gravity in a way that's really interesting and is weaponized in Fargo this season that could perhaps be a new lane for him to do other things. I will see. Who knows if anything will come of that. But to your point, in terms of comedy, this is him just like knowing how to kill this, and I think he does a good job. So we're now at the scene with George Carlin where he says that he's not going to stop the celebration. Silent Bob steals one of his golf clubs, which becomes a real deus ex machina as we get deeper into the film. But that happens. They get trapped. They basically get held hostage by Azrael and these fucking demon hockey teenagers. And this is a real sort of like, this is just Jason Lee just chewing scenery, essentially.
And this scene in this bar, which couldn't be uglier, goes on and on and on. And on.
Yes, it felt like eternity. I totally understand why Bartleby and Loki were going on this this little adventure, because eternity is long.
I also think like, this is, and again, I don't mean to keep beating a dead horse on this, but and to keep saying all of the ways that Kevin Smith is not a good filmmaker, but like the golf club reveal of the fact that it's going to be the thing that kills him goes on. He just makes such a fucking meal out of it. It's like a good minute and a half, maybe 2 minutes of like, hit me with it, hit me with it, hit me with it. Then he opens up his shirt and you're just like, we know what the fuck is going to happen here. Like, what are we doing?
Yeah. They really do. Like, he keeps like looking to Salma Hayek, who's like nodding. Yes. Like,
it's crazy.
Like,
it's crazy.
Yeah.
This is the type of thing where like, I agree with you, Sean, that for this is a pretty breezy 2 hour movie. Like it doesn't feel, but if you were better about the editing and tighter about this movie and you get it down to closer to 90 minutes, I think perhaps some of Kenny's issues, which are completely valid, I just think the movie would have moved a little bit more briskly and it wouldn't have felt so ponderous and sort of up its own ass.
Yes. Yeah. And I, what's odd is like, I mean, you're 100%, you could cut a half hour out of this movie. And it'll be great. Like, I think it would have been much better for it. But
that's what it is.
Well, we got a 2-hour and 8-minute movie.
So we get to the church and Bartleby and Loki. Bartleby is going on a killing spree. It basically has killed all the prisoners and killed George Carlin as well. They think all is for naught. basically then Bethany puts together that God is inside Bud Cort's body, which just coincidentally needs to is at a hospital within literally like walking distance of this church.
Which he coincidentally like puts together because Jason Mewes kind of like randomly says something. Yes. You're like that dead guy.
Yes.
What I will say is the hospital that Jersey John Doe Jersey is staying at is really like a 5-minute walk from the church that this is supposed to be.
Oh, I believe that.
I believe the logistics, just to be clear.
Yeah, in New Jersey geography, while it's coincidental, it actually works and tracks.
The coincidence of the geography doesn't bother me because we're in the Viewisk universe. And there are certain rules of the Viewisk universe that you just have to accept. And one is that everything that is ever important is taking place within a 5-mile radius in New Jersey. And that just
it's the Tri-Town area. That's the Viewisk universe. It's Atlantic Highlands, Leonardo, and Red Bank. There you go.
So she runs to the hospital. She disconnects John's life support. Not really sure what this film is saying about euthanasia. I'm not really sure we need to unpack it, but I don't know I don't know what it's saying.
I think that's a coincidence almost, but
yeah, I mean, seriously. And then
I will say, if he had anything to say about euthanasia, he would have said it.
A character would have literally said it.
You're totally right. Because we also failed to mention that she works at Planned Parenthood. Yes. Like he is up front, and he's like, "This is a big fucking problem with the church from the beginning." So
yeah. Although, just to be clear, early drafts, Bethany's a stripper.
Shocker.
And then he's like, "Maybe I should make her working in an abortion clinic." So like, and then he turns Serendipity into a stripper. Had to have a stripper in it. I mean, that was it. It's just a matter of who, really, when it came to. Yeah. So, anyway, Bethany is injured in this explosion. Blah blah blah. Bartleby reaches the church entrance. He's confronted by God, which is now manifested in the Canadian emo singer songwriter Alanis Morissette, which speaks to me, obviously, and I'm fine with it. But she shows up. She does some weird like scream thing that kills him and makes his head explode. Bob arrives with Bethany's lifeless body. God resurrects her and also impregnates her.
Nice.
And God, Metatron, Rufus, and Serendipity return to heaven, leaving Bethany and the prophets to reflect on the past and the future. And thus we are at the end of Dogma.
So I do really like the last 10 minutes or so. I like everything that Alanis Morissette said. I like
10 minutes.
Oh, that's pretty good. I like everything that Alanis Morissette. I like the way she looked. I like the way she doesn't talk. I like the way she touches his nose. I like her little smiles. There's just something about her that, like, if you're going to put God on screen, it's a tough thing to do, that you fail pretty much every time. And she does kind of hit this sweet spot between too serious and too twee. So I thought that was cool. I also thought Affleck sold the fucking shit out of the end of this movie. I thought he brought everything he has to the end of this movie. I think the way he broke down was great. I think the way he hugged her was great. I think everything was fantastic. I'm a very big Ben Affleck, the human fan, outside of all the bad things he's done. But I like the Ben. I like the Ben Affleck career trajectory from a like reading about it on Wikipedia page standpoint a lot. So I'm always kind of intrigued by what Ben Affleck is doing at any period in his life and career. So I thought I really thought that like the end kind of worked really nicely. And I think the end works too.
I think
I bumped it up about 20 points from where I was planning on giving it to what I wound up giving.
I think that, just to piggyback on your Alanis Morissette thing, you know, I love Holly Hunter, don't get me wrong. I mean, Holly Hunter's always great. I don't know that Holly Hunter brings what you're talking about, Kenny, to these final scenes. You know what I mean?
Too much gravitas.
Yeah. To your point, when when Alanis Morissette kisses Jason Mewes on the cheek and then just smiles, she really, to your point, like, she kind of lights up the screen. It's not something that I ever really thought I would associate with Alanis Morissette, but she is really great in it. And I agree with you that Ben Affleck brings it in the final scenes. I think the movie ends pretty strong, all things considered. What about you, Sean?
Completely agree. Love the ending. In fact, loved it so much more than I liked it, even in 1999. Because I remember being kind of annoyed at the Alanis Morissette reveal as like a 14-year-old, just because I'm like, I felt like I was very immersed in pop culture of the day. And I was like, who is this for? But then watching it now, I was like, this was great. It actually kind of solidifies it as this like perfect time capsule. It made me happy. Like it really did. And I almost feel like through thinking about Dogma all last night and today, I keep going back to the end, and it did make me happy. Like, I think I like Dogma a lot.
Oh, I didn't convince you. Shit.
I also think that I want to say something else too, because I don't feel like we've talked about him enough. But Alan Rickman is really fucking good in this movie.
He is.
Alan Rickman absolutely gets he understands the movie he's in. He understands the tone of it. I mean, we recently discussed Galaxy Quest, which is obviously a vastly superior film to this. Alan Rickman, when it comes to comedy, like, he just totally fucking gets it. And like, these are two very broad performances that he absolutely brings his A game to, so much so, in fact, that like Jason Mewes was like, he memorized all his lines because he was afraid to upset Alan Rickman or some shit like that.
Yeah, I mean, and it shows, because he is like truly the best part of the movie. And it's like also from that time where like it wasn't all British people in all of our movies. Like, yeah, so like,
correct.
So like they stood out. I think we're all better for it now because they have like they actually like learn how to do everything correctly. And Alan Rickman should have done more comedy.
It's really interesting. Cause like, you know, in lesser hands, you know, the scene when he appears to Bethany could be really clunky and bad. And quite frankly, my guess is that Kevin Smith didn't direct Alan Rickman much. Alan Rickman just got it and was like,
no. And yeah. Especially like talking about like all the would-be casting and like knowing Kevin Smith's like winkiness, I guarantee the original voice of God, he was writing it for James Earl Jones because of like the Star Wars connection.
Sure.
And James Earl Jones probably read the screenplay and was like, no, there's so much more. I don't do that much. Like, I just have a good voice. Yeah. So I just made this up in my head, but that's my assumption. But getting to Alan Rickman, like Alan Rickman, I kind of watching it in my head, even remembering it, I always thought Megatron was a much bigger character in the movie. He's only in like a couple scenes, but every scene he's in is so much better because he's in it. Like that scene in a Mexican restaurant is great, and he's like tossing out like fun little lines about like the Illinois Mexican restaurant, and I love him. Rest in peace.
Yeah. He was fantastic. He was good. Yeah, I mean
I love his face. No one has a face like him.
Yeah. So do you want to rate this movie, Kenny?
Yeah.
I think you should go first.
I'm waiting all fucking podcast.
All right.
In 99, I'm giving it a 95.
Before I watch this movie,
is this the steepest drop for you from 99 to present day?
No question about it. This and the other one, well, it's not. It wasn't nearly as steep a drop, but well, maybe it was. The American Beauty is the one that really is like, like went from like this is everything to me to like I have to just like really question what I was
think
thinking.
Most of America went through that with American Beauty, though.
Some of America hasn't done it yet, but everyone will eventually, because once you put it back in, you're like, oh, this is what I loved. Oh God, how horrible. But okay. Anyway. Dogma, 95. After this podcast or before the podcast, I gave it a 39. Mm-hmm. 39 was It's funny because I was originally going to give it a 34. I was originally going to give it a 19. And then the last 10 minutes like kind of jumped up and I was going to give it a 34. And then I remember walking up the stairs and being like, actually, I feel kind of good right now. Like I feel kind of good. I want a rating that will reflect that I think this is a bad movie, but something that makes it very clear that I do not hate this movie, which is a 39. After this podcast, I'm going to
– You missed
– What's that?
You missed a key opportunity to go 37, the most important number in the Viewaskew universe.
What is – why is 37 the most important number? I'm so embarrassed. That's
because in Clerks, she sucked 37 dicks in a row. And Kevin Smith – every jersey he sells is number 37.
37? Does that was right before the snowball thing? That was when you found out why the guy's name was Snowball?
Yeah.
So funny. That never left me because that's such a, you know, that's such an image. But 37, I forgot. I'm going to give it 39 because, you know, I went there. I wish I had thought of 37, which seems like a good number for it. But I don't think it's like the piece of fucking shit monster shit that I thought before. I would also say if I gave it a rating what I thought I was going to give it, I thought I was going to give it like a 15. So it's so much better than I thought it was. All right.
In 99, I probably would have given it a 63. I did not like this movie, but like I didn't hate it. I thought it was fine. As most of Kevin Smith's movies, when I've seen them, I often go like, sure, I get why someone might like this more than me, but I'm not the person that's going to say don't watch this. Like, if it's your thing, it's your thing. I before this podcast, I was at a 69.
Nice.
Yeah. It felt appropriate, but this podcast has brought it down. I am now at I'm at a 55 now. I think that this movie is not worth saying don't watch this movie, but I also don't think that this movie is necessarily good per se. You know, I think that I'm in the high 50s, low 60s. That's where I am on this. I think that this movie has the most Kevin Smith has to offer is this movie.
Yeah.
And for what that's worth, take it for what it's worth. Sean.
So 1999, 100%. And not 100. I did not give it 100. But in 1999, I would probably say a nice 93. I loved it. I loved it then. Going into watching it, I was dreading finding out that maybe it doesn't hold up and all that stuff. So I think I was kind of expecting this to be around like a 41. But guys, Kenny, you said it earlier. You thought it was a masterpiece, and I think so, it was. It was just Kevin Smith's masterpiece. It was not an actual literal masterpiece, but I do think it is the height of Kevin Smith. And I gave it a 3.5 on Letterboxd, so I'm gonna have to go probably 70. I'm gonna go 70, 75.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to give it 4 stars, but I talked myself out of it. Wow.
I mean, we really covered the gamut here with Dogma, I think.
I knew it would be a good podcast, not only because Sean is on it, but also, you know, there's a lot to fucking chew on with this movie, and I think we could have gotten another 2 hours, frankly. But it was great. It was really a great podcast. That was a movie I've always kind of feared doing because I knew kind of deep in my bones I hated it. So
I had very similar feelings to you, which was thank you, Sean, for coming on because you're the perfect person to come on for this. In terms of not just, you know, your adoration for the film, but just, you know,
Catholicism.
We obviously love having you on. But it's just interesting that this movie was such a lightning rod. This movie was so controversial when I don't find this film particularly bold.
At all. Like, I mean, like when you watch like The Last Temptation of Christ, you're like,
okay, I get it.
That is a lightning rod film. Like, yeah. I think like Like, the controversy is, like, is it a good movie? Like, should 1999 Matt Damon and Ben Affleck done it? Like, probably not. Like,
I do think that part of the reason why it was controversial was, one, I think it wanted to be controversial. I think that was part of the marketing campaign. And two, I do think it's pitched at 17-year-olds. And I think that there is, I think there's this idea that this is a gateway drug to maybe not atheism, but a secularism. And there are a lot of people who that scares. For me, I think I was kind of there, and it was validating the same way like Religious was validating. And now I think that's just like tripe bullshit. But like it was always validating to have someone who's in the mainstream be like, your particular brand of like agnosticism is valid in its own way. So I think there's a lot of value in this movie's existence. I just think it's really bad.
I'll say this. I when the movie was done, I thought to myself, I'm glad this movie exists. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like I don't see myself watching it again, but I'm glad it exists, and I think it's probably the best Kevin can give us, and that's
it's
okay.
His best piece, you're right, John.
Yep. Yeah. It's his best movie. I love that he had a career. I love that he still talks. Like, I think he's a very great talker. I saw him. I met him recently, him. Yeah, he was on a show I was on, and I talked to him at length about how much he meant to me when I was 13 and where I'm from and all that. And it was really nice because he was, you could tell he was like, when he goes to like Hollywood things, no one gives a fuck about him. And he seemed genuinely touched that I like tried to talk to him. But as a fat white guy, I think all fat white guys want to go talk to him. So I guess he was like expecting me to. He eyed me and was like, all right, this guy's going to come and say I meant something to him.
Is he pretty slim these days?
Pretty slim. Cool. And you know what? Like, he's just a nice guy. Like, I really do like Kevin Smith, and I do think he probably should have some level of fame till he dies. Like, I think he is, he's worthy.
And I think he really has built up a worthwhile empire. You know, he doesn't use his powers for evil. I give him great credit for that, because there are a lot of people within this world, like the fandom, who could be radicalized in a really dark direction, and instead, I think he has brought them towards the light. He deserves credit.
I think past and future guest Eric Carrasco worked with him on the He-Man animated show that they're doing for Netflix. I think that's the type of stuff he should be doing, right? Like, he loves that stuff. He should be feeding that beast and just having a good time. And listen, he knows who he is. Like, I don't think he's under any delusions.
Not anymore.
Not anymore. Maybe around the time of this movie, but certainly now he gets it. And listen, I really don't have any problems with Kevin Smith as a human, quite frankly. I just kind of wish that, you know, he was perhaps a better filmmaker at times. But
Phil, what do you want to do next week?
So next week, you're going to get a little blindsided by this one too, Kenny, because I recorded something without you. Oh, I love you, but I recorded something without you. So next week we have Katie Donahue, who's an executive and a friend, to come on to talk about Law & Order SVU. Talk about a hard turn into something completely different from Dogma. We talked about SVU premiering in 99. She has seen all 481 episodes multiple times. So she is a big fan, and it was fun talking to her about that. Do you have any thoughts on SVU, Sean? Have you watched it ever?
I've never watched a single episode. It's like probably, yeah, it seems daunting when you say something has more than 400 episodes. I probably can just never start it.
Can I just tell you something that I think you will both really enjoy? Something I learned, because I've seen less than 10 episodes of SVU in my entire life. Olivia Benson, played by Mariska Hargitay, which I'm sure you both, was kidnapped twice on the show by the same guy. Tell me that that's not ridiculous writing. A police officer being kidnapped twice by the same person?
I also have never seen an episode of SVU. I've seen hundreds of episodes of Law and Order.
Sure.
But for some reason, it just is never something that, like, I wanted to watch. I guess Law and Order was never something I wanted to watch either. That's all my dad watched for like a 15-year period.
For the record, I surmised that, which is why I did the episode.
Yeah, no. And I'm happy you did, because I would have watched like one or two episodes. Yeah. My understanding is, and this is going to sound like real dumb, Law and Order is just like a straight procedural. There's no law then. Mm-hmm. I mean, SVU, there's no law then order part. It's not that incredibly satisfying, like, bisecting of the television show.
Well, I thought the same thing, and then I was dissuaded of that notion in my research, which is that in season two there is a lawyer, so they do have the order part of the show that comes into play pretty consistently.
I thought that was the law part of the show.
You know what I meant. Jesus Christ. Whatever.
Well, it's a great episode. I look forward to listening to it. Sean, thank you for...
It's a great episode. It's a lot of fun. And thank you, Sean, for being here.
Thank you guys for having me. I love it. I'll come back anytime.
Please come back. We'll definitely have you back soon.